Live and direct from an abandoned jail cell in Desperation, Arizona Sheriff's Office, Doc, it's
the Dark Multiverse of Stephen. The Dark Multiverse of Stephen. The Dark Multiverse of.
Oh my god. It's the Dark Multiverse of Stephen King, okay?
Okay. So, Pet Sematary. We're going to talk about the movie. Yay. We're going to talk about both the movie version and the book.
Since both of us listened to the audiobook.
And the audiobook. God damn it. So, let's start.
Okay.
Oh, speaking of which, this is all spoiler territory.
Oh, yeah.
We just assume that
bad.
You've seen the movie, read the books.
I mean, it is from the 80s, so for God's sake.
Do not listen to this if you haven't seen what we're talking
That's
about
true,
or
yeah.
want to. Because we're not stopping for anything.
No.
So, anyway. One of his early books, shorter books, compared to the big crap he did later. I read every Stephen King novel as it came out.
Right.
I was working in a bookstore in Massachusetts when the hardcover version of Carrie came in.
That's amazing.
And I stole it from the store.
Right.
And I read it then and thought, holy crap. And I've read every single Stephen King book within a few months of its
that
release
is so
ever
awesome.
Since. And that was 1976.
That was the year I was born.
Yeah, shut the fuck up, okay? Yeah, thanks. But in some cases, I haven't read the books since. Some I've gone back and reread. But Pet Sematary was one of mine. I hadn't reread it.
I haven't reread it. The audiobook, I'm so grateful that I got that because it was like 15 hours of gloriousness that I was just like, oh, my God, this is so cool.
Well,
because
and that's why we went back to it is that I read someplace that Michael C. Hall had done this. And I thought, well, that can't be bad. And
he's so good.
So we got a copy of it. It's awesome.
Is great.
It's as good as
Dexter,
any audiobook I've ever heard.
And I totally renewed my faith in him. He was so good. Even how he did like Ellie and Gage's voices, like I just thought that was really good. He was awesome. I didn't know he had that kind of range.
Yeah, neither did I. And it was interesting. Good Lord, my mind just went blank. The woman that did Misery.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm looking at what else is there? I'm always looking at your boob.
Kathy Bates.
Kathy Bates did an audiobook version of Desperation.
Right.
And Kate Nelligan did a version of The Regulators. And if you go to Amazon, that's not – I think King himself is reading those.
Right.
I don't know why not. And I believe they're both abridged.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Particularly Kathy Bates does all the voices, all this stuff. She's just – incredible.
That's so cool. I love
her. They both
her.
Are great, but my God, it's worth listening to.
Yeah.
Just doesn't matter if it's long or short. But Michael C. Hall, that's the whole damn book. That's full and unabridged.
Uh-huh.
And it is.
So good.
Takes how much? 17 hours? Something
was,
like that?
I think it was like 15 plus. Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. And it just, I couldn't stop listening.
That was the whole thing. I would fall asleep to it and it would play all the way through. And then I'd have to go back and I'd like, right before my eyes closed at night, I would look and they'd be like, okay, I'm 6.5 hours in. And then I'd go and I'd find it the next day. And I'd be like, I'd go gardening and doing all the things that I do. And I'd just be listening to it. I'm like, this is fantastic. It's really, really good. I'd forgotten how good it was. It's very terrifying.
Yeah, so even if you don't want to go back and reread the book, get the damn.
Audio.
And it's on Audible. It's readily available. It is really excellent.
And also, I mean, I was surprised at how wonderful listening to that was. And I had just watched the movie. And they really did a great, fantastic job with this movie because, honestly, it's like it really follows. It's not like the typical, you know, Stephen King where it's like he wanted it to be one way in the book and they couldn't do it.
Suggested by a book, one's written by Stephen King.
Right.
Yeah. No, well, I actually disagree entirely, but.
Oh, let's fight.
Okay, let's get. Pet Sematary, the book, was published by Doubleday in 1983, nominated for a World Fantasy Award in 1986, which seems kind of late, made into a movie from Paramount Pictures in April 1989, starring Dale Midkiff, Denise Crosby, and the incredible Fred Gwynne, directed by Mary Lambert, who went on to direct Pet Sematary 2, God knows why, and a lot of other theatrical and TV movies and music videos, and is still working today, including recent episodes of The Blacklist and Arrow. It was made for about $11.5 million and made more than $57 million in the box office, not to mention 35 years of video sales since. You can rent it on Amazon for as little as $2.99 or $3.99. Buy it for $4.99. Michael C. Hall's audiobook version is available through Audible, or you can buy it on CD for something like $30 if you really want to. God, it's not on Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime for members. And the documentary, The Path to Pet Cemetery, is available on Shudder. If you happen to be a subscriber there, though, the movie itself is not. Go figure. It's certainly one of the best-loved Stephen King adaptations, particularly of his horror stuff.
Yeah.
If you take, you know, The Stand and The
right.
Green Mile and Stand By Me, rather. If you take just his horror, most of them are pretty
right.
awful.
Yes.
But this is one that people really
like. Dreamcatcher?
Really like. Yeah,
Good God.
Well, probably...
The only thing that was good about Dreamcatcher was the beautiful shots with the snow. The trailer that had all the snow blowing when it even showed, like, the Castle Rock and the lighthouse. And then Jason Lee was fantastic in that. Like, he was
and the
so
shit
perfect.
Weasels.
Yeah, the shit weasels. They were scary. They were scary, but...
Actually, the first maybe half an
oh,
hour
Morgan Freeman.
Of
oh,
that
sorry.
Movie.
I would be sinning if I didn't say Morgan Freeman.
I'll say, actually, I think all the actors in it were incredible. I mean,
I
guys have
like
gone on to do amazing
Jonesy.
Stuff
I
later.
I didn't like him.
I did. But anyway, the first half hour or so is those guys are introduced... And right up through the time that the first poor guy gets attacked by the shit weasel,
yeah.
that's a really good movie.
Yeah.
And then it just
yeah,
falls apart.
And then just falls apart.
And I don't know that it's the movie's fault or the actor's fault. It's actually not a very good book.
oh, that's, yeah.
It's really,
you know,
it's
I think
a second
the only
second
reason
rate.
Why I loved it so much is because it brought me back to Stand By Me, where yeah. it's four people together, four friends that have been friends since they were children, and then they have Duddits.
Duddits
pulls them all together, and that's he's the dream catcher, and it gets that I really like. I did like the book, so there we're.
Yeah, see, I just don't. I mean, if, in the rank of his best books,
oh,
this
God,
ain't
no,
one
it's
of them.
Not, yeah,
it's not even in the middle.
No.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any of his books are terrible. I think
yeah,
some are way better than others.
I don't think that any are terrible. I mean, in the least, it's the ideas are unbelievable, and mm-hmm. that's what makes it so fun. Is because it's like. You know, the question that he hates the most is people asking, where do you get your ideas, you know? And it's just like, well, fucker, I have a colander in my head and some shit sits through and some other stuff doesn't. So it's, you know.
The late Harlan Ellison, when he was asked that question, would always straight-facedly say, well, there's this guy that I buy them from. I said, what? He said, yeah. I pay him good money, big money. And at the 3 a.m. every night, he slips an envelope under my door.
It's your crackhead dealer.
And there's another idea for a story in there because I can't do this shit. And people would like half believe him, and it was great.
That's so funny.
Anyway, Pet Cemetery, what we're supposed
Pet
to be talking
Cemetery,
about. Anyway.
Yeah. And we have the movie on right now.
And we have
in
the movie
bedroom.
On right now. And we're watching. And
we're watching in bed.
Interesting. I think among the many problems with this deal is I think most of the acting is really not very good.
Yeah.
I think Midkiff is not. The book, we see the slow decay of this completely normal guy.
Right.
To the point where he's, by the end of the book, he's
yeah,
totally
he's
insane.
Yeah.
You know, wandering back into the woods with the body.
I know.
Midkiff seemed just a little bit like Jack Nicholson in The Shining for
right.
me and nobody else. He was crazy from frame one. He didn't
right.
go crazy.
See, that's the whole thing, yeah. With Shining, the first good third of the book is him having issues with his anger and his dad.
And
but
struggling with
it's
the growing
struggling with
madness
the alcoholism.
And instability. Yeah.
But then when he gets into the hotel, it taps into what it knows is
the worst
his,
of him.
Yes,
yeah.
exactly.
And really, though it's actually some years earlier, I don't know how many, this is the same way. Doc starts out normal.
Yeah.
With a little bit of a problem,
right.
but nothing.
Yeah, no, he's very normal.
And then he's very shaken by the accident in his new clinic.
Okay, but here's the thing. Before that even, I noticed something that doing the audiobook made me realize that Stephen King during this time was dealing with his own anger issues and his own, mm-hmm. you know, cocaine and alcoholism and all that kind of stuff. So the way that Lewis talks to his wife in the book is fucked up. Like, it's not nice. Like, he's, like, impatient. Like, he's even telling himself in his mind, like, I'm impatient with you. I'm impatient with the kids. And then he, like, tries to keep his voice normal and then says something.
And so you think that's King dealing with his own issues rather than he wrote this character that was...
Well, it's basically, in this movie, the reason why I think I like the movie better than the book, the character of Lewis, is that he seems like a mild-mannered, nice guy, whereas in the book, when I was listening to it, he really seemed like an asshole on the inside, and he was just being nice on the outside.
That's
but then
really
maybe that's parenting back then.
Well,
maybe all parents feel like that.
Well,
I
just thought of it as this specific situation, that he was a guy who loved his family,
right.
but was somewhat disconnected from them. He was a full sociopath where they were just set pieces.
Right.
But he thought about, and in fact, King himself, when the wife says, you know, you decided to build a pool, and this is in the book, not the movie, decided to dig a pool, you didn't even ask me. You just decided to do it. You decided to come here and do this, and you didn't, we didn't talk about it.
Now, I think that's also how marriages were back when he wrote this book, maybe. I don't know. Again, I'm newly married and in a whole different generation of marriage.
I think it was far more likely that the guy just
took the reins
and the woman just followed. King interestingly points this out a number of times, that he makes all these major decisions without consulting her, deciding to move out to this little town and do all this stuff. And she just goes along, and there's a growing resentment in her for this. And it does pay off in the worst possible way for him. This episode of The Dark Multiverse of Stephen King is brought to you by the 1990 Castle Rock Merchant Association, with a special message for residents and visitors alike. Be sure to visit our revitalized downtown district to see all the great new shops that are opening up. Sure, we've had some rough times recently, but good things are happening and we want you to be part of it.
Talk to Leland Gaunt, the new owner, and you'll find he knows exactly what you're looking for, even if you don't.
You know, Kat, the prices at Needful Things are so low it's scary, especially for all those one-of-a-kind items like a rare Sandy Koufax baseball card.
Or a carnival glass lampshade.
Or the first edition of Misery's Lament signed by Paul Sheldon.
Or a fragment of wood that might actually be from Noah's Ark. Whatever you really want, it's waiting for you at Needful Things. They are always ready to make a deal.
So come visit Mr. Gaunt on your next trip downtown, or plan a special trip. Everybody's dropping in. And if Mr. Gaunt isn't there, well, you can always talk to his assistant, Ace Farrell. He's a pretty sharp guy, too.
He sure is. That's Needful Things in downtown Castle Rock. Keep an eye out for its sister store, Answered Prayers, in Junction City, Iowa, home of the library policeman.
One of my problems is that the book slowly builds on all these things, on their casual estrangement. Then we must be, 50 pages in before he has that horrible first day at the clinic.
I know.
We get a lot of time to meet his next-door neighbor. To meet Jed and all that stuff. And if you watch the movie, all that happens in 27 seconds.
Right.
And we never really get to see the relationship he has with his wife. Also, her really pretty weird hatred of death.
Yeah.
Doesn't want to talk about it, doesn't want to deal with it. Gets really mad at him in one of the great scenes of the book and the audiobook, where she yells at him for talking to the daughter about death at all.
Yeah.
Then the kid becomes normally, as they do, obsessed with the death of her cat, which hasn't happened. All that's not in the movie.
Right.
We go straight to the premise. And my current idea is that probably all Stephen King books should be miniseries.
I think so, too. Because, I mean, Storm of the Century, which we'll get to at some later date, is fucking so good. And it's one of those ones that's just like, I can't, you know, I read he wrote it as a screenplay, right? The book.
Yeah.
It's like written as in, you know, you got seen this, and that was like, it was a little jarring at first.
Like Rose Red, the other one.
Yeah.
It was original screenplay.
Right. Yeah. Where it's like, you kind of have to get back into the, okay, I have to read it like this, and then your mind starts making the scenes in your head. Okay, so let's talk about Pascal.
Pascal. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Pascal in the book disappears early on.
Yes.
And we never see him
again.
He kind of introduces the whole concept of this is a terrible place, be careful.
Right.
And then he's gone.
Which I think actually makes more sense.
Yeah, and in the movie, he's there.
He lingers on the whole time,
And by the same token, the little girl,
Ellie,
doesn't have any psychic powers in the book.
Now, that was something that I thought was really weird, too. She did dream about church dying. And she was so, I mean, it does seem like she does have a little bit intuition, you know.
But nothing like the movie where she's having
predictions,
visions of exactly what the hell is going to happen all the way through.
Now, see, in the audiobook, though, Rachel left because Ellie was having hysterics about,
that's
you know,
true, about
so
someone's
she
going
did,
wrong at that. But at that point, everything was going, I agree. Yeah. I shouldn't say she had no psychic powers or nothing, but nothing like here where she's a typical Stephen King kid in the movie.
Maybe it's because it's so condensed.
Well, that's it. And here's the thing. We got to remember, Stephen King wrote the screenplay.
Oh, maybe that's why I like the movie so much.
But this is one of the little... Stephen King does not really write very good screenplays. Even when he writes his own stuff, they tend to be highly convinced.
Brad's going to hell.
I know. It goes straight to hell. Now, again, I like Rose Red and I like Storm of the Century. But a lot of his other things, Maximum Overdrive and this and a lot of the other things.
Now I'm the sinner. I didn't read that.
It's a movie only. There's no Maximum. We'll get around to it someday. Believe me, it'll be
one day
down the road. That's we'll get really drunk and watch it.
Oh, my God, because you have to get really drunk and then just rip on it, like Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Exactly. Yeah. That's about what Maximum Overdrive deserves. What's interesting is, like we're talking about Dreamcatcher, all the actors in Dreamcatcher went on to do, I mean, we had Thomas Jane and the guy who played Jonesy, who's done tons of great shows, and all of them went on to amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody that made Pet Sematary ever did.
Oh, my God, that's true. I never saw any of these people ever again.
Midkiff went on to do a bunch of TV and then kind of faded. Tasha Yar, excuse me for a moment, never did another series, did a couple things, and she basically does conventions now.
And I take a drink. Cheers.
The little girl never did anything else.
You think she was all traumatized and shit from this?
No, there's a documentary about the making of Pet Sematary that
you
can watch on Shudder. It's not very good. King didn't want anything to do with it, so he's not interviewed.
Oh.
Most of the actors are, and they're now that they're old, including Midkiff and Tasha, and that guy, the guy that played
Pascal.
But none of them really did much later. And, of course, Fred Gwynne, God bless him, this was his last, essentially his last movie. He died 2 years after this was made of pancreatic cancer. And you know how old he was when he made this?
No.
How old do you think he looks in this movie?
68.
Yeah, we were being generous. I think he looks like 70-something. He was 62. He was
really?
2 years younger than I am.
Oh, my God.
He just always looked that way.
Wow.
And, in fact, the producers did not want to use him.
Really?
Yeah, they were afraid that no one would remember him as anything but Herman Munster.
Oh, come on.
And they wouldn't take him seriously. Oh. And,
dude, even South Park still uses his voice and does things. Everybody uses his voice. And, in fact, I love that Michael C. Hall, actually, in the audiobook, he really encaptured, in my opinion, totally did the...
Well, and that's Gwynne. Gwynne, when he made this, said he wanted to do the full Down Eastern, Easterner thing.
Yeah.
Even though the accent is broad and open to parody. He thought he could pull off a character that actually talked like that, and you would believe. And he did. He is by far the best thing about this movie.
Oh, he really
is. And I think it's why people remember it with such fondness.
Well, sometimes that is better.
If you go back and watch it for real, like, the practical effects around the crazy kid at the end are laughably awful.
In the movie?
In the movie.
Which crazy kid at the end?
When the little boy, he, like, drops out of the attic. Or you see him with the little scalpel and stuff.
Okay,
and like,
okay. You know what's so funny is, so watching the movie again, I had to watch the movie again. And I remember, like you said, I remember Jed so fondly. I remember, you know, all these different things. I remember loving Gage saying, not fair.
No fair. I do too. That's a great little scene.
No fair.
But the weird thing was is that when I watched it again recently, because I hadn't seen this movie in so long, you're right. I was like, this isn't as good as I remembered it to be. And him flying out of the thing, I was like, it's like Chucky before Chucky Chucky.
This movie is better in recollection than
it really is
in re-experiencing. Sometimes
it's true.
Go back, like we're watching Rose Red right now. It's as good or better than I remember it.
I actually like
parts of it that I'd completely forgotten. Main reason I went back to watch it is that one of the actresses in it is in Castle Rock.
Oh.
But so I went back and I thought, oh, wait, this is really pretty good. Mm-hmm. Watching this, I thought, oh, wait, this really isn't
very
good at all.
This isn't very good. These characters are very beige.
Well, and they rush a lot of things. In the book, the relationship with her parents is really well drawn.
It
the
is.
Father's an asshole, tries to bribe him not to
marry her.
He's a shitheel all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we get to the awful moment where the kid's coffin collapses and they have a fist fight,
it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It's horrible, but it makes sense.
It's the last straw.
And this,
like,
you don't even know this guy.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, he's
you just know
like,
he doesn't like the parents. You don't know all the reasons
why. There's
like
two lines in the movie that say, yeah, they don't like me very much. I don't like them either.
And there's one time that's both in the book and the movie when she's talking about Zelda, her sister.
By the way, do you know that that's a man?
No.
The actor in this is a male.
Oh, I did not know
that.
Yeah,
that's one of the few good things to watch. The Making of Pet Sematary thing that's on Shudder generally is not very good, but the two really interesting things I found were finding out that they didn't want to use Fred Gwynne and a conversation with the young man. That's crazy.
I love it.
Yeah, I know. Oh. And he never did anything else either. This was like his one.
That's so, it's like a curse. So what I was going to say is when Rachel's talking about Zelda and Lewis says, if I ever needed another reason to dislike your dad or hate your dad or hate your parents or something like that, now I have it. Because that's when she confides to him about Zelda and the dirty secret and how they know. And she was glad that she was dead. And it's the, you know, her, it explains so much about her crazy fear of death and just wanting to avoid the topic altogether. But anyways, that's the only time that they really address that he actually actively hates the dad in the movie.
And it's like three lines.
Right, exactly.
And,
mm-hmm.
and so that his appearance later, the scene of the collapsing coffin should have been one, as it is in the book and the audiobook, of kind of unmitigated horror, the worst possible thing. In the movie, it's kind of stupid. It's kind of like over-the-top, silly, soap opera-ish. Because it doesn't make any sense in terms of the characters or the scene.
But I would definitely have to say, like, this was really well made for most of the 80s movies that are super cheesy and over the top.
Well, particularly, nobody was spending big money on horror movies.
No, and that was the thing. Every year I would wait for Halloween just to like have a horror movie. And I was like, oh, and when Stephen King ones would come out, I'd be like, even if it sucks, I'm still excited. But yeah. Ugh.
Next, in part two of Pet Sematary, not Pet Sematary 2. Oh my God, no, that's awful. In our second part about Pet Sematary 1... we'll ask only the important questions, like, are the Mi'kmaq Indians for real? What is up with church? Why did Lewis think that this would work out well at all? And what's with the ending, guys? All that and more in the next edition of The Dark Multiverse. never mind. Get our show notes and transcripts and lots of other cool stuff at darkmultipod.com. That's our website. Join us on Twitter at darkmultipod. Or on Instagram at, strangely enough, Dark Multipod. Our beautiful theme and bed music here is used by the generous permission of Chrysanthi Tan, a brilliant musician, composer, and performer. And you can visit her website at chrysanthitan.com. It's spelled like chrysanthemum without the mum. Get it? No? There's a link on our website, don't worry. And become one of her very lucky patrons over on Patreon, too. It is so worth it. You can follow Brad at TheBradMunson on Twitter or visit his website at bradmunson.com. And good luck tracking down Kat. She is a dream of a ghost of a fantasy when it comes to the damn internet. Thanks for joining us. Like and review and refer and spread filthy rumors about us like for everybody else. You know, the usual. And we'll see you soon. You could get a little closer, like put it between your legs, so to speak, as it were.
As it were. Yeah. Prop it up.
That's perfect.
There we go.
Yeah. That way.
Straight, live, and direct from Cat's crotch. My hey, manny.
Yeah.